If you ask the best in the world the single greatest secret to success, they'll smile and give a gentle laugh. You're asking the wrong question. Being extraordinary is not a single element. It cannot be distilled down to one thing. We're told that being a success is a magical thing that happens in a place you'll arrive. The hard part is that this long-held truth is the biggest lie. Extraordinary features humans that have reached the top of their field and become extraordinary humans. The door to being extraordinary is now open. Will you walk in? Hey everyone, Jeremy here. You guys are in for a real treat today, as I actually have one of my favorite authors with me, and somebody that up to this point, he's written 19 books in the series we're going to talk about today, but 20 books overall. He's a New York Times bestselling author. Welcome to the Create Your Own Life show, Brad Thor.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
Absolutely. And we're going to be talking a little bit about your new book today, Near Black, which I just got a copy mailed out from your team. So excited to kind of dive into that. But I want to kind of start at the beginning, Brad, because one of the things I found really interesting, you know, about what you've done is, you know, you moved to Paris right out of school and decided you were going to write a novel, and that isn't what happened.
You know what? No American has ever done that. That was pretty cool on my part. I'm going to go to Paris and write a novel, right?
Right.
You know, it's funny, and with cancel culture going on and everything, I am going to take a big risk and tell you what was playing on the tape in my head when I went to Paris, okay?
Sure.
Paris, I wanted to write a novel. I got a couple chapters into it, didn't know what it was going to be, turned out to be a thriller. And I started having this nagging voice inside my head that I think we all have, saying, what if this is no good? What if you spend a year writing this and nobody buys it, nobody likes it? Maybe it's better not to risk the embarrassment at all. And so back to my cancel culture line, where I'm really walking out on a limb here, I grew up, and one of the most powerful PSAs I used to see growing up was from the United Negro College Fund, which is a mind is a terrible thing to waste, okay? And so I had actually shortened that in kind of my sense of humor applying to myself, that the mind is a terrible thing, period, because it often stops us from doing that which we know we're destined to do.
Yeah.
And so I had they weren't even laptops back then. They were called slab tops. They were so thick, like a huge phone book. I shipped it back to the United States. I traveled throughout Europe with the money I'd saved going to college that I was going to write my book with, and ended up getting into television. And it wasn't until my honeymoon that my wife said, what would you regret on your deathbed never having done? And I said, writing a book and getting it published. And she said, okay, 2 hours every single day when we get home from this honeymoon, you need to start working on making that dream come true.
It's interesting because you mentioned, you know, getting into television around that time. You actually were running a public television show. I think it was either before or after, you know, Rick Steves' show around, you know, the travel world while, you know, producing the show, putting everything together, raising the money for the show, the production,
posting,
writing 2 hours.
Yeah.
How did that work?
Well, so they used to air us back to back, me and Rick Steves. And I always thought that travel made me a better American because I got to see my country from outside and realize not only different ways of doing things around the world, but how blessed I was to be born in the United States and how many things I was taking for granted other countries didn't have, and so on and so forth. So I had come back from living overseas and was actually interviewing to go into the agent training program at William Morris at the time. I was going to go do a whole career in TV and film, and I had pitched public television on this idea. Let's get young people to travel now. I wanted to tell people, don't wait till you're retired to see the world and experience everything there is out there. And so the day of my last interview at William Morris, it was with the head of the TV department. I got a yes from public television. We're interested in this show. And so in the middle of the meeting, probably the only, like, you know, young kid out of college that's ever told one of the agents, ah, I may have a TV deal or maybe I'll come and work for you guys. It was kind of funny. And he said to me, he said, Brad, he said, it's so obvious to me that you are a creative person. You don't want to be an agent. He said, go grab this opportunity with both hands. Go do it. And so it was terrific advice, which you wouldn't expect anything less from William Morris than terrific advice. So I did that, did it for a couple of years. And then it was, like I said, when I was on my honeymoon, we had finished the second season. And my wife said, you want to write a book? If that's your big thing, you got to do it. So I actually started writing after second season of TV and just never went back to TV.
So then how long did it take to put that together? Because the first book at that time was The Lions of Lucerne. You know, how long did that take you to make that first book out?
Well, it took about a year for me to research and write it. But what was interesting is on an overnight train ride in Europe during my honeymoon, my sponsor at the time on public television was Rail Europe Group, the people that create and distribute the rail passes to all the travel agencies and so on and so forth. They, as a wedding gift, they had given me and my wife as many overnight train rides as we wanted. And the last leg of our trip in Europe was to go from Oktoberfest in Munich to Amsterdam. And it was the one train compartment we couldn't get a private. We had to share it. And I was thinking, oh, I've been in so many of these overnight things with really sketchy customers and everything. And I was really not looking forward to it. Plus, I had an Oktoberfest size hangover when I got on the train for this overnight train ride. And it turned out that sharing our compartment was this lovely brother and sister from Atlanta, Georgia, who traveled every chance they got, were big fans of my TV show, and she worked at Simon & Schuster. Wow. I didn't know that. We spent all night talking about our love of travel, love of books. The next morning, we went to exchange business cards. And before we did, she said, well, you're going to go home, make some more TV shows. By that time, I'd already told my wife what I wanted to do. I figured the more people I tell this is my new goal in life, the more I'll solidify it and bring it into reality. And I said, I'm actually going to go home and write a novel. And so when we exchanged business cards, she said, you know what? If you actually do it, send it to me, because if I can help you at Simon & Schuster, I'd like to do that. So it was perfect timing.
I love that. It's always interesting, those like chance meetings you have. My wife and I traveled from Bratislava to Vienna via train. And it's such a cool experience to just, you know, meet new people that you never know, like, you know, where they're going to come back into your life, just like you're talking about with Simon & Schuster.
Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite Stephen King novels, and I was not a Stephen King reader. My wife had loved The Stand and everything, was Bag of Bones. And the protagonist was an author. We were going from Athens to another port to catch a boat to go to Venice. Mm-hmm. And there's a lovely couple on there. And we all were like, hey, do you have any books that you're in your backpack or whatever that you're done with? And we traded and I got Bag of Bones. And it was one of my favorite books ever. So yeah, you never know who you're going to meet. That's half the fun of travel.
One of the things you've mentioned before that I heard in another interview, Brad, is you mentioned that when you're writing, you can write like 2,000 to 3,000 words a day. Like, I don't know, I write a 900 word article and I'm like, oof, I'm spent. So I guess, like, how are you able to keep that level of output? And then I guess when you're going back, do you slash a lot of that? Like, how does that work?
Jack London was famous for saying, you can't wait for inspiration, you have to go after it with a club. Mm-hmm. And so my average had always been, particularly beginning early on, had been about 2,500 words a day when I was writing. And it slowed down a lot. I don't do 2,500 a day now, because I'm so focused on the placement of every single word. Not that I wasn't before, but
sure.
I don't know what it is now, but I'm so hyper focused on my craft. And that's what keeps it interesting for me.
Sure.
And hopefully interesting for the readers. I've got to come up with the same protagonist in 19 of my 20 books. And I want each book to stand alone. So if you've never read a Brad Thor book before, you can start with Near Dark. It doesn't matter that you haven't read the earlier ones. So I'm trying to get better as a writer. And so I'm really agonizing word by word by word. And so I'm still getting a book a year done, but the amount of time that you don't see that I'm spending in my office has really grown, because it's just very, very important for me. So, you know, if I do a 1500 word day, I'm happy. I'm thrilled. If I do a 2500 word day, that's fantastic. But normally, no, I don't slash. Every single word I put down on the page ends up in the final book. Unless my wife, who's got a great eye, says, you know what, you actually said this once before, you're repeating yourself, take that out. And that may be like a paragraph or something.
Right. So you mentioned the Near Dark being a standalone book. And that's the really cool thing about your book series. You know, it's similar to how James Bond is set up, right? Like, we can watch any film and get it. I know for myself, the book that I came in during was the book State of the Union. Then I went back to the beginning and kind of caught up and then, you know, kept going from there. Was it your idea to do that? Was it a publisher's idea? Why was it so important to have a series that's a standalone so people can come in on Scott Harbath's story anywhere and get it?
It's a great story. Yeah, great question. And I use the James Bond example all the time, right? Mm-hmm. We've got the, hopefully, I wish they would release it now, the 25th Bond coming out. I can't wait to see it. All the trailers look so good. So originally, I had planned on Scott Harbath in The Lions of Lucerne, my first novel, and that was it. I loved Michael Crichton for a long time before I was ever an author myself. And so I liked the idea of I could create new characters every single time, a new protagonist. I didn't have to ride with the same person. Mm-hmm. And my publisher said to me, my editor said, everybody here at Simon & Schuster loves this character. You have to do more. And I said, I don't want to. I want to have the freedom to do different stories and different characters every time. And she asked me a great question. She said, How many authors do you read right now because you love the character? And even if you picked up the book, she said, pick one place in the world you think is completely boring and you'd never, even if somebody offered you a free trip there, you wouldn't go. So I picked some place. And she said, now, what if your favorite author set a book there with your favorite character? Would you read it? And I'm like, yes, the character. She said, this is what people want. When you introduce them to a character they love, they want to keep coming back and having an adventure. And it becomes, particularly now with the lockdown and everything with the pandemic, I'm finding people like, you know, release it early. We're at home. You know, it's comfort food. We know Scott Harvath. We want to go for another, you know, thrill ride with him, another great adventure. So it had not, Jeremy, been my intention to keep going with Scott Harvath, but that realization that my editor helped me come to that, you know, once you love a character, you want to keep coming back. That was the big moment for me where I said, okay, yeah, I'll do him as a series character.
I guess then looking at that then, you know, like this character of Scott Harvath, like, was there someone that was an inspiration for you for that? Because he's very much a patriot. He's kind of on the edge of, you know, kind of doing what needs to be done sometimes. And it's not always the thing that needs to be done, but it's the right thing. So like, where does that character idea come from for you?
So Harvath is a mix of a lot of different people that I know who are in the intelligence community, in the special operations world and everything. And it came from listening to a lot of people talk, particularly some of the post 9/11 stuff, which is we heard a lot about the Geneva and Hague conventions and the rules of war. Sure. Yet we had an enemy, Al-Qaeda, that, and Islamic terrorism in general, that was not playing by the rules. So if I hold up a contract and show it to you, Jeremy, and say, I signed this, so now you have to give me the keys to your house. You'd be like, whoa, I didn't sign.
I didn't sign that.
Need two people to sign.
Right.
So America had this growing tidal wave of enemies that had not signed on to any rule book. And I thought to myself, okay, this is really interesting. What if you could have a scenario where the government picked somebody that had a good moral compass and said, listen, don't go out there and just do stuff for the sake of doing it. Go out there to achieve your mission. And we're going to kind of turn a blind eye. And if you've got to do what you've got to do to make it happen, because there's no Marcus of Queensberry with these guys. They hide behind women and children. They plant bombs that kill civilians, as well as at the very basic level with those conventions, you're supposed to at least appear on the battlefield with an armband that shows that you're a combatant. So the idea that they wouldn't even do that much really intrigued me. And I thought, okay, what would we be willing to do as a nation where we could still be proud of who we are, but protect ourselves with an absolutely ruthless enemy? Where's that line where you have to say, okay, no, we're not going to play by the rules if these guys aren't going to play by the rules, or we're going to bend them a little bit if it means that your wife, my wife are not killed going to the movies tonight together. So
absolutely. And the thing that I think is really interesting, you know, looking at Harvath's character development, right? He's kind of a loner, but he does often find the girl and then he eventually settles down, but some rough times happen with the girl. Like, can we expect in the future that Scott Harvath is finally going to get to be happy in his love life, Brad?
I think so. I think particularly with Near Dark and the way Near Dark unfolds, I think readers are really going to love it. I created the female characters in my books are not just window dressing. So when I have female characters, I'm surrounded by brilliant and talented women. So whether it's my agent, my editor, my wife, I mean, it's just on and on and on. My VP at my company, these people are just incredible. And I have a daughter. So I want to be writing characters that all of them can say, wow, that's an amazing character. And that is somebody I aspire to be like. So I've created what I think is a really cool female character in Near Dark, just as broken as Harvath, just as troubled, just as dark of a past as Harvath. And I kind of liken it to what would happen if you dropped two coffee cups on the floor in your kitchen at the same time. And if you could only find enough pieces to put together one cup out of those, what would that look like?
Right.
You know, it'd be a Franken cup, but maybe it'd be a little bit bigger than one or the other of the two that broke. So that was kind of what I was playing with in this book, is how do I have just action on all the pages, a lot of emotional stuff, and then just two really cool characters that you as the reader were like, are they going to get together? Because I'd like to see them get together. Oh, no, wait, they're going to do this now. And just kind of keep people flipping those pages, because that's what I'm in the business of doing. I want you to just be like, oh, I can't put it down. I got to read one more chapter before bed.
I guess then looking at them, like, you know, you and I were talking a little bit before we recorded here, like two of my personal favorite authors are yourself and Dan Brown. And the thing I find just very interesting, which always grabs me about your work, is it's hard to figure out, you know, where the reality ends and where the fiction picks up. Like, they're very well researched, you know, everything's very realistic to a point. So I guess for you, in terms of like, when you're researching and putting together, you know, things so it is believable, like, how important is that to you? And how much time do you spend on detail there?
So I am a real detail guy. I'm a perfectionist. And I believe that the details are the bedrock of a great thriller. So for instance, my wife, if she picks up a book, she will finish reading that book. Me, no. I'm kind of a 2-3 strike guy. Mm-hmm. So if you're writing a novel and one of your characters has a Glock and you say he flipped off the safety on a Glock, there's no safety on a Glock. There isn't. That's not how the Glock pistol is built. That's one strike against you from me, because you could have found that out if you had done a little bit of due diligence. So I'm a big, big detail guy. Now, do I make mistakes? Absolutely. And I own them. It's nobody else's fault but mine.
Sure.
But back to that story about me going to Paris and getting shipping my laptop back home and traveling, I had told myself, no wonder so many authors become drunks and even suicidal, because this is such a lonely profession. That's what I thought. I was wrong. I could not get the details right that I do without the help of so many other men and women, whether they be in the military, law enforcement, intelligence. I'm blessed with the network that I've built over almost 2 decades of doing this. So details are really important. And Jeremy, one of the nicest pieces of fan mail I get is if it's from somebody at the CIA, FBI, in the SEALs, Force Recon Marines, Delta, whatever it might be, where they say, wow, you really get it. That's the kind of gear we use. Or, oh my gosh, we had that same situation in our office and we dealt with it exactly the same way. You know, I'm not writing an instruction manual, but I want to entertain you and have it be as real as possible. I want to take you up to the line and let you peer over the hedges to see what these worlds are really like while, you know, making your heart pound in your chest as you flip those pages.
And in terms of, like, you know, the realisticness of it, you've actually been in a program for a while with Homeland Security called the Red Cell Program, along with Brad Meltz and some other authors. You know, I guess, what has that experience been like? And, you know, I guess you can only speak to a certain amount of it, but how do you assist the government as an author?
So in the wake of 9/11, the federal government, before the 9/11 commission was ever convened, they said, we got hit because of a failure of imagination on our part, and we're never going to get caught with our creative pants down again. So they said, we need to stop thinking like bureaucrats, like typical just government. Bureaucrats is the perfect word, although it did incorporate military thinkers and intelligence people. So they said, we need to break out of the way we think. And they said, let's bring in creative thinkers from outside the Beltway, outside DC, and let's bring them in to brainstorm with us about what the next attack might look like, where it might come from, blah, 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 blah. So that was the analytic red cell unit at the Department of Homeland Security. So Meltzer, who I love, Brad is one of the nicest guys in the world. Meltzer was there. Michael Bay, the director, Transformers, the Benghazi movie, he was there. And it was our job to come up with attack scenarios, potential targets. They'd say, if you had an apple and a box of crayons and there was a parade downtown and it was the day of the eclipse, what might you do with all that kind of stuff? Just weird
stuff.
Sounds
like a MacGyver story.
You had to wonder, were there like little pieces of intelligence they had and they were asking us to kind of assemble them and show them? And we would never know. What we did know is that our stuff went to Congress, it went to the White House, all this kind of thing. So my dad is a Marine, no longer active, and it was an incredible honor for me to get asked to serve my country, not by picking up a rifle, but by using the gray matter between my ears and to do for the government what I do with my books. Now, the Red Cell program, I call it the Las Vegas of government programs, because what happens in the Red Cell stays in the Red Cell. I can't put it in my books. Right. I can't talk about it. The only one scenario they ever published that I am allowed to talk about is they looked at how terrorists might exploit a hurricane headed for the United States. So a lot of times we'll move heavy equipment, ambulances, and other kinds of things out of the path and then marshal them someplace so they could come quickly in afterwards, targeting relief shelters where people might be gathered. That's the only one they've ever publicized. And I came up with an attack scenario in the Red Cell, and it ended up happening overseas.
Wow.
Exactly the way I had laid it out and everything. And so I reached out to my person there and I said, hey, okay, this is in all the papers, it's on TV. Can I say that we war game this and I came up with this in the Red Cell? And he said, absolutely not. We don't acknowledge anything. We don't talk about it. We don't say, we do not let the other side, the bad guys, know what we're thinking about, what we're not thinking about. So I couldn't say anything about it.
I guess then, like, you know, looking at someone like Tom Clancy, right? Like, his books have been made into films. They've been, you know, made into, you know, the Amazon Prime show. I was reading them at 11. That was a really long books to get through as somebody that loves Tom Clancy. But has that ever something you thought about that, you know, there could be a Scott Harvath movie or series or something like that that comes in the future?
I think it's the dream of every author. And for a town like LA that's filled with beautiful people, I think I've kissed every frog in that town. We've had so many opportunities that for one reason or another, the executives at the studio change and it's kind of like a new lion comes into the pride. So all the Cubs get killed, all the projects get killed. We actually are involved with probably the best team we've ever been involved with right now. And we're working through the pandemic to line everything up so that we're ready to go. And I think, knock on wood over here, that we've got a super, super team because the people that came to us and said, we want to work with you. And I said, okay. And I said, what would next step be? They said, well, we want to put you together with the director. And I said, okay, I've got a very short list of people that I would ever want to touch my books. Mm-hmm. And I said, who are you thinking of? And they gave me three names. And the first name on the list was exactly the director I wanted. It's like, if you could wave a magic wand in Hollywood and get the director you wanted, because I wanted him to say, well, we could get anybody. And I would have asked for this guy. He was the top of their list. He's my favorite director. And he said yes. So we've got an amazing Academy Award. God, I think this guy got nominated 10 Academy Awards for the producer, the directors. I mean, if I told you who these people were, you'd be like, oh my gosh. So, but because I've been back and forth and to the altar many times, it's tempered my excitement, but I am really excited because the caliber of the creativity, the movies these guys have made, the success of these movies is fantastic. So, and my dream come true would be to do a hybrid, to do a TV show like you see on Amazon Prime or Netflix, but also then mix in feature length films as well. So you get a season of shows, then you get a 2-hour movie, then a season of shows and 2-hour movie. That'd be the best to play with, because I was a creative writing and film and television production major in college. So I would love to dabble in both film and TV with these. I've got 20 books. That's like getting the Marvel universe. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no end of characters you can spin off and different series you can start. So, and I think that's a big, big advantage to what I bring is that entire universe. So we'll see what happens, but it's going along very well.
If you, Brad Thor, could choose the person to play Scott Harvath, you know, who would that be? I'm pretty torn who that would be, Brad.
It's a great question. And here's what we've been asking ourselves. Let's say we're going to start with a movie. Okay. Yeah. Does the star make the movie or does the movie make the star? And we're all saying the movie should make the star. Just like nobody knew who Sean Connery was before the Bond stuff. I don't want to take somebody like, listen, I think John Krasinski is a great actor. Mm-hmm. I particularly liked him in the Benghazi movie. I thought he was fantastic. You know, but there's a lot of people who may look at him and see the guy from The Office, right?
That's exactly what I saw.
Yeah. So what we're talking about is we want people to see this actor as Scott Harvath from the get-go, as opposed to, oh, I remember he did this movie and that movie. So we're right now leaning very heavily towards the project is going to make the star. So that's, I think it's going to be an unknown, or it's going to be somebody that maybe you've seen them do a TV show here, TV show there, but this will be the thing that really breaks that actor out.
Well, I guess then bringing a background to story development, Brad, like the book that's in my mind right now that I'm thinking of is your book, Spymaster. Mm-hmm. And the storyline in there is like, I thought about that and I'm like, wow, imagine the national security and intelligence things that could happen if that situation happened. I know like in the news, it depends on which political party you're listening to, but there's been discussion about, is Joe Biden losing it? You know, what's kind of going on there? And, you know, in that book, there is, you know, the spy master doesn't have his wits about him
because he's Alzheimer's. Yeah.
I guess like when you're looking at like story development, like where do you come up with these ideas with? Because if you think about that, that's an incredible storyline.
In the shower or after the second glass of wine. That's where I come up with these. It tends to be, Jeremy, when I'm most relaxed. Mm-hmm. And so this has been an interesting thing with the pandemic is my wife only wants to watch light, easy TV. Mm-hmm. So game shows or comedies. And it's killing me because we only have so much time together at night when I come home from the office and all this kind of stuff. And so we do watch TV together, but I'm really into stuff like Ray Donovan and Counterparts. There's all these great, and it's such an
Billions is a great show if you've gotten a chance to see that one.
I can't wait to get back into it. But every single night where I'm like, let's watch another episode of Billions, she's not in the mood. And I get it. We're all stressed with the pandemic. We're all dealing with it in different ways. And I really believe we have to support each other and be good to each other through all this. So usually my process is I have to keep a pad of paper and a pen on the coffee table because I'll finally relax. So when I say I get my ideas in the shower or after the second glass of wine, it's when I'm relaxed.
Right.
So if I'm watching good story, like I love Ray Donovan. I love that series on Showtime. And I'll have things pop up. It's just stuff. There's something about losing myself in a really good story that'll pop things in my own head. And I'm also a voracious consumer of news. And I like to say, so you talked about the first book of mine that you read was State of the Union.
Correct.
So for those who haven't read State of the Union or listened to the audio version, the premise was, what if we really had not won the Cold War? What if the Russians tricked us into believing that they had been defeated, that they were giving up? And they decided, we're just going to sit back, collect aid, quietly work on our weapons programs, and then choose our moment to come back. So that's how my mind works, is I see something and say, what if, right? So we talk about the glass being half full, half empty. I want to set it on my coffee table, crawl under the coffee table and look up through the glass and say, what does it look like this way? And what if it was like that? To come back, Stephen King had said, and it's a great line, that a writer is someone who has trained their mind to misbehave. Mm. And I think that's really the key, particularly for my business, is to say what if, to constantly be challenging everything. What if it went this way? What if it didn't go this way? What if something else had happened and it turned things like this? That what if is the rocket fuel that gets me through a year of writing. If I come up with really good what if, because that's what the book is about.
Well, I guess in terms of your process then, like of actually writing, like, you know, I've written nowhere as much as you have, but like, I guess for myself, I always start with the beginning, the end, write the middle, then match the beginning, the end back up. Like for you, are you writing straight through? Do you write certain sections and reunite them? Or what's that process like for you?
So it's funny you should mention Dan Brown. Mm-hmm. Okay. So 1 year, I'll give you my Dan Brown story. So 1 year, since Dan and I have the same agent, my agent said, you know, you should talk to Dan because I'm very organic. I don't outline. Dan does. Mm. And so I reached out to Dan. I'm like, how's that? Seems to work and everything. And he said, well, I'll share with you. You can't show it to anybody else. I'll share with you the outline for Da Vinci Code. Mm-hmm. So it was an incredibly detailed outline. It was amazing. I got to see scenes that never made it into the book, which is really kind of cool for Da Vinci Code. So, but I can't do that. Robert Frost once said, no tears in the writer, no tears in the reader. No surprise in the writer, no surprise in the reader. I have to have the same experience writing the book that you're going to have reading it, or it doesn't work. And it's tough. It makes my job so hard. And that's part of why I've pared down the amount of words I write in a day, is I'm really pushing myself, whether that's the son of a Marine, both my parents were entrepreneurs, whether it's the Midwestern values, I want to get better with every book that I do. I don't work for Simon & Schuster. I work for you, Jeremy. I work for my readers. So when you go to Amazon or Goodreads, you know, and you leave that 5-star, that's my annual performance review. And so my number one goal is to never let you down, never phone it in. So there's a tremendous amount of pressure on me, but just the way my head works, I'm very organic. I've got to kind of, there's lots of nights where I'm banging my head against the desk because I'm like, what am I going to do? I don't know how to get out of this. In fact, Near Dark, just to give you the genesis of Near Dark, my current book, last year for the book Backlash, we had a retailer, a big national retailer, say, hey, would you write an additional chapter? Give us a bonus chapter so we can have a special edition to sell to our customers. Well, if you're a business partner with me, my first answer is always yes. I know a lot of people go to no because they don't want more work. My thing is always yes. If it keeps you happy, if it helps you move more product for the both of us, the answer is yes. So I got to the end of writing Backlash last year and had to come up with a chapter. And I was going crazy, going crazy, going crazy. I couldn't come up with anything. And then I did. So my publicist had said, he's so funny. He said, if Backlash was meant to have an additional chapter, you would have written it. It would already be there because you show up all the ends and everything. Well, I came up with this idea that it's kind of like, you know, the film credits come up. You watch the credits at the end of the movie, it goes to black, but then at last
it's like the Marvel movies.
Bingo. So we're back to kind of the Marvel universe thing. So right. I had that happen last year where all of a sudden the movie comes back up and it's this, the third largest city in Vietnam. And there's this European guy with bodyguards and then this Vietnamese ex-intelligence agent. And there's all this piles of cash on the table and he won't use currency counters. He's got a bunch of naked women so they can't steal the money, counting out $10 million because he's just so eccentric. And if you're wondering, what, there's this banter between them. You don't know what it's about. And at the end, you realize that the European guy, for some unknown client, has just taken out a $100 million bounty on Scott Harvath. Mm-hmm. And he says, task all your assassins at once. Whoever gets to him first gets the $100 million.
Wow.
Well, that was great bonus chapter, but it becomes part of the Thor universe, just mm-hmm. like it would be part of the Marvel universe. I can't start this year's book and have my guy wake up and say, "Oh, that was a bad dream. Can you imagine if they put a $100 million bonus?" So it was really tough to get started for me, Jeremy, because I took that chapter, made mm-hmm. that the prologue for this year's book, and then said, wait a second, my guy's the best in the world. If he throws his phone into the ocean, you'll never find him. So how are assassins from all over going to track him down if he doesn't want to be found? So I had to rethink this whole story. At the same time, I find out that the John Wick movie is going to be about all these assassins hunting down John Wick. And I wouldn't let me, and I love the John Wick franchise, and I wouldn't let myself watch the latest Wick movie. I finally did. And I was like, it's not what I'm doing, because I didn't want to be accused of, you know, cribbing things from Wick. And I didn't.
Right.
And the stories are different. But it really pushed me. I really painted myself into a corner with this one. But the way I handled it, I'm very, very proud of. And I'm actually glad the bar was so high.
Mm.
It keeps my job interesting, keeps it challenging to keep moving it up.
I've heard you say about it before, like that's been the challenge when you paint yourself into a corner writing, because there is no, you know, deus ex machina, like mm-hmm. in your writing. Like there is no like, oh, he snaps his fingers,
no cheating.
Fixed. There has to be a solution.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to do that. Yeah, and that is, if you can maintain that honesty in that reality, you're going to keep people on the edge of their seats. Because if I, as the writer, I joke that I come home some nights after painting myself in the corner, and my wife can tell if it's a red wine night or a bourbon night based on how stressed I am. And she always says, don't worry about it, you're going to figure it out. And that happened multiple times. But I think the quality that you see reflected in the book of the action and the intrigue and everything comes from my willingness to make hard choices, to paint myself into a corner. And that's when having that network is really good, right? Mm-hmm. So I can reach out to my guys and say, all right, if you were here and this happened to you, what would you do? And I've had a couple of them go, wow, ooh, I don't know how you get out of that, but we're going to figure it out together. And so that's the great thing about having the network that I do.
It's funny you mentioned that. I had the founder of Bullet Bourbon on not too long ago, and he said his decision is he's always trying to figure out, is it a bourbon night or a rye night, which I guess is a little bit different than a wine or a bourbon night. But Brad, you mentioned that network. You seem to pull on that network a lot for, you know, whether you have questions or inspiration. Like, how have you developed the network around your writing?
It's like anything else, right? You got to get one foot in the door and ingratiate yourself and then, you know, get led to other contacts and things like this. So I had a neighbor when I was in college. Their unit had been at the same compound that used to be called the Fiesta Cantina at Fort Bragg, where Delta Force was. And now Delta's got a new compound. They've had it for a while. But these guys, this was brilliant. During the Cold War, the U.S. Army had gone through the Ranger battalions looking for soldiers who had had German spoken at home, native German, when they were growing up. And they grabbed these guys, taught them how to be fantastic spies, and they worked on their guerrilla warfare skills and then dropped them in Berlin. They used German
wow.
soap, they bought German clothes, they had apartments. And their job was, if the Russians, if the Soviets ever came over the wall, their job was to slow them down long enough for NATO to pull together a defense and to push them back. Mm-hmm. And so one of these guys was my neighbor in LA. Terrific guy. Friend of the family's was friends with a guy who's amazing. His name is Harry Humphreys. He was one of the plank owners of SEAL Team 6. He works with Bruckheimer. Every movie Bruckheimer does, Harry is in there as a technical advisor and stuff. Mm-hmm. So slowly, these people started introducing me to friends of theirs. I started going to SHOT Show every year in Vegas, which is the big shooting, hunting, outdoor trade show where there's a heavy military component there. And I bought a lot of steak dinners, a lot of pitchers of beer, and just kept my mouth shut and listened to what these people talked about and all that kind of stuff. My dad's best friend, who's like a godfather to me, was a big guy with the FBI. So just a handful of contacts I spun into mm-hmm. a greater and greater network.
I guess then looking at it, like going back to, you mentioned earlier, you know, your first book, The Lions of Lucerne, you know, the chapter development was longer. And over the years, you've worked on your craft, it's shortened up a lot. And I think one of the things that's interesting is, like, I know for myself, one of my favorite books is Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. And
it's
a really long book for people that haven't read it. But Ayn Rand spends pages on describing or setting up a scene or something like that. But you've gotten very good and concise at being descriptive and having enough there and setting it up so that people can get what's happening. I guess, how has that process for you changed over the years? And how has, you know, I guess, reader attention span, I'm assuming attention span going down because we're more technological, how has that all changed your writing style?
It's a great question. So Elmore Leonard had a fabulous piece of advice he used to give young writers, which is leave out the parts that people skip. a great piece of advice. But my dad, when I was growing up reading the Clancy books, I would get them after my dad had read them. And my dad would swear that Clancy must get paid by the word because they were so long. Mm-hmm. So another thing Stephen King says is that you should write what you love to read because that's where your passion is. Mm-hmm. And I add on to that, if you love thrillers and you've read a bunch of them, you have a mini PhD in that genre. You know why some are good, some are great, why an author you like, their fifth book clunked, but then they got it back on the sixth book and all that kind of stuff. I don't need to know how a guidance system on a missile works, nor do I need to write about it.
If you've read The Hunt for Red October, you may be able to steer a nuclear sub. I don't know.
Yeah, probably can. But for what I write, I want to talk about the two guys on the ground who are lasing the target. And the missile is going to find that building they're supposed to hit based on this laser that the human eye can't see and all this kind of stuff. I don't need to go through gyroscopic things and stuff like that. It bores me. I'm not writing technical manuals. And I've had a couple of guys at like the CIA say, oh, Thor, there's no way, you know, it would go from this to this. And I say, yeah, I get it. I know there'd be 8 meetings with different people. You'd have to go here and there and then make sure nobody was following you. I said, but no reader, I'm not writing an instruction manual. I can't have 8 meetings before my guy gets to the woman he needs to speak to. I said, that's the difference between you and me. Yes, in real life, you might have to change cabs 12 times and 6 buses. Nobody's going to sit through that. So you have to find the balance of reality and entertainment. And there's a lot of people that come out of the military and out of the intelligence world that have great ideas for stories, but it doesn't necessarily mean that's going to translate into a page turner. And then there's plenty of people that have great ability to tell stories, but no ability to research, and the details aren't there. So it really is tough to kind of thread that needle and find that balance.
I think that's really interesting, though, because that kind of connects perfectly with the next thing I wanted to ask you. And a lot of people have said that the first chapters of a book sell the book, the end of the book sell the next book. But really, the thing that's interesting about your books is I feel like each chapter sells the next chapter. And I guess, like, as somebody constructing that type of a thriller, you know, like, how do you create that type of tension puller?
Well, so I lived in Paris, right? One of my favorite stories that I learned living in Paris is about Count of Monte Cristo, which I consider one of the original page-turning thrillers. And so Dumas had been hired to serialize his book in a French newspaper. So you had to leave a cliffhanger to get people to buy the next edition of the newspaper to find out what was going to happen next. And so The Count of Monte Cristo is one of my favorites, but you're exactly right. I think it might have been Mickey Spillane who had said the first chapter sells the book, the last chapter sells the next book. So that's what you're doing. If it's a page turner, those cliffhangers are important. And for me, it's the natural musicality, if you will, of the entire book. You have to have those. You have to take people up and drop them, but then take them up again and drop them and take them up. There's just a rhythm to doing this, not a formula, because formulas won't work, but a rhythm. And so that gets somebody to the end of the chapter. And then I want people to say, oh, it's 2 in the morning. Just one more. Just one more. The greatest intro I ever get when I do stuff is, the reason I didn't get any sleep last night is because of our next guest, Brad Thor. I figured I'd read a little of his book before we interviewed him this morning, and I couldn't put it down. That's music to an author's ears.
I guess then, like, you know, bringing it back around, just because we're running a little bit low on time, Brad, and I want to make sure I respect your time. We had a few listener questions for you. You know, my brother-in-law, Phil, is a huge fan of your books and has, you know, he's consumed them all, and he's actually considering a career in writing. And I guess if you were giving somebody that's an emerging writer advice, you know, what kind of advice do you give him?
I always quote a line. I always ask people, do you know what the difference is between a published author and an unpublished author? Mm-hmm. And the answer is the published author never quit. Mm-hmm. So it is all about going after it. I'm a big believer in, if you've got a great book, you should be able to find a home for it. I think a lot of people run to self-publishing, and that's fine. It's a completely different animal. You don't get the support in the network that you would with a traditional publisher, but everybody has to make their own choices. The one thing I love is that when you look for an agent, when you're querying an agent, they all say, well, send us your query one at a time. Don't send it to multiple agents. But I always say, if it takes 3 months for an agent to get back to you and you have to go through 12 agents before you finally find the one for you, that could be 3 years of your life. Sure. So I say to people, don't listen to the agents. Pick 5-10 agents you like and shotgun it out. And whoever's smart enough to snap you up first gets you. Mm-hmm. So that's a little inside baseball stuff. But the big thing with being published is to just never give up. I mean, I got a stack of rejection letters before I ended up getting my agent.
Right.
It wasn't until right about when I got my agent that I got that contact of mine had worked me up the ladder at Simon & Schuster, and everything kind of came together at the right time.
And then I guess one more listener question for you is, this is from Uli Isserlo. He's a big fan of your books, and he wants to know, as a marketer, it's about storytelling and keeping people's attention. So I'd be interested what he thinks marketers can learn from his craft in order to keep more attention as somebody doing marketing.
Wow, Uli, good question. One of the things, so you talk about me having gotten my chapters and made them shorter, crisper, more cinematic, I realized that I'm competing for people's time and attention. So I'm competing against TV, the internet, all that kind of thing. The one thing, and I don't know if it sharpens your marketing, I know it sharpens my passion and my determination and my dedication to my craft, which is if you buy a hardcover for $25, you can go out and make that $25 back again. The one thing you can't make back is the time that you give me to read that book. Time is finite. You only have so much of it. So I really see this as a calling. I mean, this really is a passion for me to be a writer, but there is the entertainment there. So if you're a marketer, you've got to constantly be thinking that the person, you want them to hang on every word, right? So my chapters end with a cliffhanger, so you go read the next chapter. You have to visualize that the person you're appealing to, whether you're an author, whether you're a marketer, is constantly got somebody pulling on their leg, whether it's a child at home, the phone's ringing, there's a constant competition. So what are you doing to keep re-engaging them, even if it's sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph? For me, I do it chapter by chapter so that I don't lose them. That's really important to just keep, you know, just keep hitting them with something they didn't see coming.
Mm-hmm. Brad, just as we're winding down here, like if you were to take a look at something you believed at 21 that you don't believe now, what would you say that is?
Wow. Something at 21 that I don't believe now.
Yeah.
It's funny because I think the mind is like a parachute. It has to be open to work, right? Mm-hmm. So I've always been very broad-minded. That's part of why I love traveling, was to see different ways of doing things. I wish I'd had this question in advance, Jeremy. I could have given you, you know what? I spent my life every single day waking up, including at 21, and then now I'm 50. Every day I stood in front of the mirror expecting to see an adult staring back at me. I still don't see one staring back at me. So this idea that somehow you've got to give up that kind of wonder of your personality, the things that we all look at young people, we love the energy, we love the excitement, the joie de vivre, the grabbing life by the throat, choking everything you can out of it. I guess if I had to pick one thing, it is you don't have to grow up. Mm-hmm. You have to be responsible. You're married. I'm married. I have kids. I mean, I have to be responsible, but I don't have to grow up.
Sure.
But I'm an artist. And I think there's a lot of the child that's in the artist. I think that's necessary. So I may not be the best template. I don't know if you want an airline pilot that didn't grow up or a surgeon that didn't grow up.
That doesn't sound safe.
But I can imagine that's a relatively relaxed person. Maybe he doesn't get as stressed out. So you know what? Next time we talk, I'll have a better answer for you. That was a real, it's a great question, but it reminds me of like James Lipton at Inside the Actor's Studio, where he had the, you know, what's your favorite word? What do you want God to say to you when you arrive in heaven? You know, everybody knows to come prepped for those.
Well, absolutely. Once again, we've been talking about the book today, which is Near Dark. It's going to be in bookstores everywhere in the 21st. So as you're hearing this, it is out there for you to grab. Brad, you know, what can we expect from Scott Harvath in this latest installment?
Well, as we talked about earlier, he's got a $100 million bounty placed on him. And I went to one of my spies and I said to him, I said, what do you do if somebody put a contract out on you? He said, the only way to kill the contract is to kill the guy that put the contract on you. It's the only way to do it. So as opposed to Harvath sitting in one place waiting for somebody to turn up that maybe can turn the tables on, he figures out a way they can drive towards the person. He doesn't know who it is. He just knows his contract's out there. So it is a really exciting cat and mouse. I've got a great female character that he becomes involved with in this book, Norwegian intelligence officer. Some of my favorite locations around the world I wrote into this book. There's a beautiful UNESCO World Heritage site on the front, Mont-Saint-Michel in Normandy in France. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite places. I've always wanted to put it in a novel.
That was the first thing my wife said when she saw the cover.
Oh, she recognized it right away?
She's been there, yeah.
And I've been there twice, and it's awesome. So that's part of the fun for me to do these things, is I can go to these places, do the research, and then put them in the books. So this is just a really fast, fun read. It's got a lot of spies, a lot of action, a lot of emotions, very deep book. And I think it's something people are really going to enjoy.
Absolutely. Well, once again, the book is Near Dark. It's going to be in bookstores everywhere on the 21st of July this month. Our guest today has been the author, Brad Thor. Brad, where can people find out more about you and where can people grab this book?
BradThor.com, BradThor.com. It's the perfect place.
Very cool. Well, Brad Thor, thank you so much for joining me today on the Create Your Own Life show.
You bet, Jeremy.